Hello and welcome to the season finale of
Mixtape Memories.
I'm Matt Hartspade.
And I'm Jenners.
We have a very special guest today, the lovely Sharon Van Etten. How are you doing, Sharon?
All considering, pretty good. How about you all?
Yeah.
The last few months have been a wild ride for sure.
That's to say the least. Yeah.
How are you doing in LA? I know you have family and you have a new pup and everything.
It's strangely like we're really busy, and because of COVID and domestic life and working from home, I feel like it feels busier than it has in a very long time. And because I feel like people are learning boundaries, but yeah, I'm good. I've been writing. My little one's super into superheroes right now. So Robin is his go-to. Uh-huh. And we just got a puppy a week ago. He's about 9 weeks old. And
he's adorable.
Yeah, it was like my son was finally going to bed and he's potty trained and now we have pee all over the place and we're not getting sleep. But it's really fun though. It's really fun all considering.
Yeah, you've been busy the last few months with the obvious, but also I've noticed that you've been releasing songs kind of one here, one there over the last few months, and they've all sounded beautiful. But the ones that I think are most specific maybe to what we talk about here on the podcast would be your cover of Nine Inch Nails Hurt, which I love, and then the cover of Portishead's Machine Gun for the Stereo Gum compilation. So can you kind of take us on that journey of picking those two tracks and what kind of drew you to them in terms of revisiting them at this moment in time?
Absolutely. I mean, the timing is kind of funny and long-term in a way, because when each of them reached out to me to make those songs, it was pre-COVID. And I was touring a lot, and I knew that I wanted to do it, but I said, if I'm really going to do it right, I'm going to have to wait so I can do it in a studio when I'm not in a temporary place, and I can devote time and energy to an interview and a song and all those things. So when I finally had the time, it was during COVID, and I was like, this is the perfect time. My studio was finished the month before COVID hit, and I was assessing all the projects that I had in this limbo, and they kind of made sense together too, because they were songs that I connected with very deeply when I was in junior high and high school and learning how to handle my emotions, and the only way I could express them was through music, because I wasn't a very good talker or communicator, so I very much needed connection through songs in order to feel like I let out that angst. And Machine Gun came later, but Portishead was the band that got me through high school, and then I didn't get turned on to that record and third until like later in life. Definitely got me through some hard times. The Nine Inch Nails song, that song was on a cassette that my brother gave me that was a hand-me-down from a box of cassettes that he didn't want anymore when he went to college, and he left those behind for me with my Walkman. And and yeah, they got me through some tough times.
Yeah, I love what you did, particularly with the Hurt cover. I feel like you really kind of put your own spin on it. And I noticed a lot of the YouTube comments were kind of noting that you didn't take the obvious approach to it, you know? Huh. Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. Thanks. Well, lately I've been writing a lot with a drum machine, and either with a guitar, piano, or a pad. And, you know, I think it's just such a beautiful song. And I think finding my own way to share it with people to show that I really do connect with it, and that I do find it in my own voice, and when I hear it in my head, it's something that I'm saying to myself. And I think a lot of people that are fans of music, they hear themselves, they connect with that, like being their point of view. And so it's, you know, I was nervous to cover it because I am such a fan, but, you know, there's always that tricky cover delivery of, am I going to try to stay true to it and like own it? Or am I going to try to reinvent it a little bit without being offensive. So hopefully I walk that line.
Have you ever thought about doing a covers album along the lines of like Cat Power? Because I feel like that would be so great.
I've actually considered doing like jazz interpretations of my favorite songs ever.
Nice.
And then also just doing a classics covers record, like a la the cover we did for Peace, Love, and Understanding. Mm-hmm. Because it just, you know, I always liked musicals and classic cinema, but I never thought of myself as that kind of a singer. But when I got to do that one song, I kind of felt that. I was like, maybe I do want to sing in, with like an orchestra. You know, I mean, that's not really an option right now, but maybe one day.
Oh, I could totally picture that. That would be epic. Oh my gosh, with your voice. Oh my gosh.
So yeah, I was hoping we could go all the way back to your roots, which lead to Jersey, correct?
That's right. Hey, you know it.
Yes. What kind of stuff you were listening to as a kid, and maybe what kind of influence your parents had over, you know, what kind of records they had in their collection, or like you mentioned, your brother as well had a certain influence. So where did you kind of grab influence from, and what were you drawn to early on into your teenage years?
Well, my parents were very avid music fans, but they came from, there's some overlap, but most of the time they were very different sides of it. So my mom got me into musicals and doo-wop and more soul songwriter, like Del Shannon, the Everly Brothers, Carole King, Joni Mitchell, stuff like that. And then my dad was more rock, like Jethro Tull, the Beatles, Rolling Stones, the Kinks, you know, Mott the Hoople, stuff like that. So
he's a cool guy.
Yeah, I mean, there's like, you need kind of both, you know. It's kind of you know, Neil Young was like the bridge. and so like, yeah, Rolling Stones was a bridge, Neil Young was a bridge, the Pretenders were a bridge. So like a lot of classic things on both sides, and like obviously the Beatles, like everybody loved, and Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers was, you know, I'm one of five kids, so when you go on a road trip, you all had to agree. So it was Tom Petty, Bob Dylan, the Beatles, the Traveling Wilburys.
Yes.
Those were the agreements that we came to. But,
okay.
But my little brother was like, Tom Petty was his favorite for sure. And then my little sister was like all pop. So she was like Christina Aguilera, Britney Spears. And then my older sister was alt girl. So she got me into like Juliana Hatfield and the Lemonheads and Blur, and my older brother was total grunge guy. So like, oh, what was that? Ned's Atomic Dustbin.
Yeah, oh, I remember that.
Yeah, like Gin Blossoms, Soul Asylum, Nine Inch Nails. Yeah, you know, just the whole. Buffalo Tom.
Of course.
And, shoot, I'm missing a big one right now. Matthew Sweet.
Of course.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. So, like, all that coming in there. And, like, I'm kind of, like, all grunge rock. But I kind of liked it all.
It'd be funny to hear your interpretation of, like, one of those big late 90s pop songs. I mean, for kicks. I don't know what, you know.
I don't know. You could give me the ultimate challenge. What, you know, third track my way.
I think what a girl wants, Christina Aguilera.
Wow. All right. Wow. Okay. Assignment. I'm serious. Hilarious.
Yeah, because you have like such a soulful, sensitive, really thoughtful voice in your music. And I do feel like your interpretations kind of reflect that. And yeah, that would be super interesting. I bet you would do like some kind of deep shit that people that would just blow people's minds.
Who would have thought you could cry to Britney Spears? I don't know. Maybe that's the jazz standard.
That is the standard, totally. Boom, boom.
All right, I'll work on it.
The cabaret version. This actually leads nicely into something I wanted to talk about today is that, you know, the first time I saw you, I think, was at Cake Shop during CMJ many, many moons ago. And I think I just kind of stumbled in and you were playing upstairs, like a street level. And, you know, there were a handful of people there and I was just like really blown away by your voice, by those early songs. And then I want to say that you played pianos like an hour or two later, and then I just went there as well. I was like, she's really good. I want to see her again.
So, that sounds like me. Yeah. Wow.
And then kind of, you know, we had, you know, I saw you a bunch in those early days, and then that kind of led into when I put together that Morrissey compilation and you covered those two songs that are so beautiful that still exist somewhere in the internet, somewhere on YouTube, they're still there. I think that was the first time that I, and we don't have to talk about covers anymore after this, but saw what you could do with a song and kind of make it your own, you know? A lot of people reached out to me who weren't familiar with you when those songs were put out back in like 08 or 09, and they're like, who is this? Tell me more, you know? So there's something about your voice that I think is so inviting and intriguing, and I think that's why, you know, you've had such an incredible career the last decade.
It's crazy to think it's been 10 years. Are we that old? it's funny when I think about that long ago, but I remember just saying yes to everything because I was so excited. You know, uh-huh. I'm like, did I really just go down the street? I guess I did. but that was such a beautiful and vulnerable time. And I had no idea why I had this drive. Like I never thought I, you know, could realistically be a musician as a career. And I just, you know, it's nice to still love it, even when it is a job. But it's always been a, you know, I was passionate back then for God knows why. And it means a lot to still hear that you connect with the music and
of course
to see familiar faces after all this time. Thank you for always being so supportive. I just want to say that.
Of course. It was kind of crazy when I saw you last year at Beacon Theater when you headlined Beacon. I was just like, this is such a graduation from Cake Shop being surrounded by like the latte machine. You know? I mean, how is that? I mean, I saw you there a few years earlier when you opened for Nick Cave, which I felt like was such a watershed moment. But then when you got to headline it, I don't know, for me to kind of witness that, I was like, this is just kind of bananas. And I'm just wondering how you felt to be on that stage and to play kind of a hometown show to such a full room, to all those thousands of people.
I mean, to be honest, not to downplay headlining Beacon, which was incredible and emotional, and I still can't believe that we did that. But you know, I feel like at every level I've been scared and nervous and have needed that. Like Cake Shop meant everything to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm so sad that it doesn't exist anymore. I know Andy will find something else because that's what he's really good at. You know, that shaped me so much. And every time I felt like, okay, yes, maybe I graduated from the next venue up, but like if I hadn't had that raw experience, that intimate experience that I, in some ways make me more nervous than like opening it, you know, for somebody else in like an arena or whatever. I'm like, this is more soul bearing to me when I can actually see people from the staff to the people that come in that don't have any idea who you are. It's like those intimate connections make me feel more vulnerable than if I'm playing a place like Beacon. But what Beacon represents is my journey and the, like, how long it took me to get there and being a hometown show and like seeing so many familiar faces and in a theater that as large as it is, it still feels very intimate. And I've seen some of my favorite shows there, as well as just, I don't know. It just means a lot in terms of feeling like a New Yorker at that time that it meant everything.
Yeah. Now I hear what you're saying in terms of kind of those intimate rooms can be more intimidating because you know, for a long time, I did the press for Cafe Carlyle, the, you know, the cabaret room on the Upper East Side. And, you know, sometimes we'd have names in there that play significantly bigger rooms, but they're either testing out new stuff or they just want to connect more with an audience. But I remember we had Debbie Harry in the room, which was just, you know, mind blowing. But she was so incredibly nervous, which makes sense. You know, I mean, in that space, it only holds 80 people and they're seated right, literally right under you. So that's got to be, there's no breathing room, sort of speak, you know?
I know people are eating and like they're relaxing and they're there for you, but it's still like, you could touch somebody if you wanted to.
You really could. Yeah.
Do you have to try to like transform yourself into a different space? Or transport yourself rather like to a different space when you're on a stage that is a bit bigger and like less intimate to kind of get into a different headspace?
Absolutely. I mean, when I was solo and I was just like in my jeans and my t-shirt, like I had to close my eyes and play. Mm. And then as I started playing with other musicians, which, you know, I was a late bloomer to that. I didn't really start playing with other people until 2010. And then I was at least able to look at the other bandmates and I was like, oh, I can open my eyes and think about something else and like connect on a different level. But then as like the run of show kind of changed and there's transitions between songs and there's less room to talk to like unnerve myself, that it was more of like, you know what, actually getting into like a different outfit instead of what I've been wearing all day. And just, even if it's just putting on lipstick or, you know, it kind of, it's like the illusion of putting on a costume when it's really just an elevated version of yourself. Mm. But I felt like that helped just by feeling like a change of scene, feeling like a step outside of myself, even if it was still myself. That helped a little bit, but I like to be quiet before I go on stage and I like, you know, to like breathe a little bit. And if I can do vocal exercises to think about something else too, just until it's like you're on your mark and set, go. All right. Freak out.
Going backwards a bit, at what age did you decide to leave Jersey and come to New York? Didn't you have a stint in Tennessee? Is that true or that's some random Wikipedia thing?
It's true.
It's true. It's true. I didn't realize that.
You know, in high school, I was in musicals and I was in choir and I would go to musicals in New York all the time with my mom. And I wrote silly songs with my friend Dana. And I played the talent show once on guitar, but like I wrote like Ween kind of songs, you know, they were like silly. Like I think one lyric is there's a gangster on the corner, pants blowing in the wind. And it was just about like someone wearing JNCOs on the main street, drinking coffee or something. And like, that was all I knew. I was like, I know how to sing. I'm learning how to play guitar, but it wasn't like, I am a singer songwriter. This is what I'm going to do. And you know, growing up, it was the only path was high school, college, job, and being a musician wasn't really taken seriously. I mean, they encouraged the musical interests that I had, but not as a career. Mm. And the only path that I found in college was at a recording, like as a recording major in Tennessee, and because there wasn't a recording major in New Jersey. So I found this college through my AP music theory teacher, who is also my choir leader. And it was in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and it was called Middle Tennessee State University. And they had a recording major for production and technology. And at the time I thought, oh, cool. Now I made it out of high school with like a 4.0 and I did decent on my SATs, and now I can go to college and take all the classes that I really want to take. And then you get there and you have to take all that shit over again. You have to it's like, I have to take English. I have to take algebra. Like, I struggled to get A's and B's and now I have to do it again. And I was like, F that. Like, I am sorry. So after a year of going, I didn't fail out or like drop out. I just decided after a year that I wanted to take a break and not go home. And I stayed in Tennessee and I ended up getting a job at a venue. And well, it was a coffee shop that started having shows and became more of a collective and got a record store. And then I was learning how to put on shows and help put like support bands, and they would crash my house. We would hook them up with food, and it was a small place, but if you couldn't get a show in Nashville, you could get a show at the only like all ages club in Middle Tennessee. So I saw some pretty cool acts and I learned a lot from that. And at the time I was in a relationship that was really unhealthy, and I just would play guitar and sing and write. And it was right before I ever recorded, it was just all in my head. And I would play open mics, and I met a lot of people that way, and they said, oh, like, what's the name of your band? And like, it kind of like went to, oh, and people are connecting to these really sad songs about my my love life. So like it kind of started there. Mm-hmm. And then I was there for about 4 years or so, and when the relationship was really bad, I decided to move back to New Jersey with my parents, and I stayed with them for a year to get back on my feet. And that's when I started playing out again and going to New York and just trying everything. And I got a job, and just things kind of unfolded from there. But it wasn't until my mid-20s that music started to become something I took more seriously. Mm-hmm.
It seems like going to Tennessee and kind of going through that whole process really like was an education in itself in a lot of ways, just laying a foundation for you.
Absolutely. My mom calls it whenever she tries to like back me up because I didn't go to college, she would be like, because she went to this school of life.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, yes, I did. You know, I learned a lot. I mean, I had... Even when, like, kind of, like, I disconnected from my family, I checked out of school, I got a job, I was self-sufficient, and even though I struggled, and, like, I lived in a shithole, and, like, you know, I was living off minimum wage, and my rent was, like, $280 a month for, like, a one-bedroom on the top floor of a house that didn't have a front door. It was, like, my door to my apartment like had like 2 inches off the floor, so we got mice and stuff, but it was mine, and like I felt really independent, and I learned how to survive and also to do the thing, like find like what's my thing, what do I love even when it's hard. And I felt very lucky that my parents welcomed me back and let me stay with them to recharge for a year, and they encouraged me to go back to school part-time and get it. They're like, if you go back to school part-time, see a therapist and get a job, you can stay here for a year. And that changed my life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know you mentioned we both mentioned Cake Shop and some of those earlier venues, Pianos. I was wondering if you could maybe discuss your relationship with some of the other venues that were super supportive. I know Zebulon's on the list, right?
Zebulon was a big one, because Pianos, like I met Billy Jones, who used to book shows like Shanae Bar, I think was my first show ever in New York, and then he also booked upstairs at Pianos and then got me some shows there. And like I was still getting my confidence and learning how to play to like a loud room of like, you know, pool playing people. It was just like it's like Friday night at like 11 o'clock. Like, do you want to hear acoustic guitar at a bar? Like, cool. But, you know, you play these weird slots and like you learn how to deal. And I don't know. It gave me like, it was like I was always up for the challenge, and it helped me get out of New Jersey. So he was an early supporter who now does Babies All Right, as you guys know. And I think he helps with National Sawdust.
I did the press for them when they first started. Yeah.
Yeah. And so like I know he was a part of that. So he's always done really cool things and has encouraged a lot of, I don't know, just eclectic music and just an accepting character. And so my friend Kip Malone, he was like his brother was my friend, like one of my best friends in Jersey in high school. And he actually gave me a mixtape that we can talk about.
Yeah.
But so like I reconnected with him by seeing a show at Bowery, and it was Celebration, and Kip Malone was opening up for Celebration. And I introduced myself, and like, he told me he still had family in Jersey, and that anytime I wanted to come and visit, he was down. But then also, like, he still had family out there, so when he came to visit, like, he would reach out. And so we built a friendship that way. And he would take me to shows to show me different neighborhoods, and he was just very welcoming early on. And he took me to Zebulon one night, and you know, they had this amazing mint tea with like a little bit of sugar in there, because I knew that I had to drive back that night. And his friend Patrick was one of the people that helped with music there, and he like DJ'd and was like, he did a little bit of everything. And Kip gave him a CD of mine and said, you should have her play here sometime. And then he reached out to me later, and I played a show there. And Josh and Jeff were there, who are the brothers that are the owners. And they just said, you and the people around you are so nice that anytime you want to play a show, we welcome you here. Consider yourself part of the family. And, you know, not so many words, but mm-hmm. I felt accepted, you know. And so I anytime I reached out, I was able to curate my own nights there. And that kind of turned into like a thing for me, because I there weren't many venues that I kept going back to as like a residency kind of a mm-hmm. feeling. And so I got mm-hmm. to curate the nights, pick the bands, and my dad would drive out. It was a family affair. It felt really nice, and it's really comforting.
That is really nice. Yeah, I feel like that doesn't exist as much now. I mean, obviously in the age of COVID, but even pre-COVID, where I don't know, where a venue will kind of take time with an artist and grow with the artist and give them the space and the ability to do something like that. I don't know. I mm-hmm. just think it's rarer, at least in New York.
Yeah, you know, I mean,
it's
I think
not the same.
I mean, Rockwood still does residencies, right? I feel like I've gotten
That's
to
true.
See. No, it's interesting. Zebulon was definitely just, you know, it was very nurturing, and you know, and I feel very lucky that they're here now. Although, you know, who knows when I'll see them again, but hopefully soon.
Yeah. Do you want to tell us about that mixtape?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So Colin's brother, I mean, I knew him as Colin, and he's changed his name since. He was like super involved alternative music. But on the mixtape, like, he had a band called Honey Rider with another one of his friends that was really fun. And, you know, they encouraged me to play like a benefit for Amnesty International at like a sister high school. And so we all used to hang out and like go thrifting together and like driving cars recklessly. And, you know, we would always go to the state arts fair together and like just be silly on the lawn while everybody else was taking it seriously. But one of the tapes that he gave me, it had Tiny Lights on there with this song called Evil that was amazing. And then a lot of, like, it was the first time I had heard Pavement. Mm-hmm. And there's also Sonic Youth on there, which I hadn't really heard. And then all of a sudden in my like junior year of high school, I start getting like really into like noise, the noise side of rock and grunge. And that, yeah, that was, those are the three main things on that mixtape that were pretty rad.
Were you like a giver of mixtapes too?
I've had my fair share. You know, I actually got like a boombox to try to do it on the radio again, to like just the incomplete.
Oh, wow, old school.
Yeah. But I was like, the incomplete kind of, you know, like you don't catch the first song, or you're just recording the, you know, you just recording the end of a song, or you hear the DJ about to introduce a song, you know, that yeah. you love. But I also got a boombox because my little guy, he started getting into like early hip hop, and he really likes Curtis Blow right now.
Yeah.
And so
nice.
There's a song called like Do the Do. And so I found this whole like lot on eBay of all these old cassettes that so he can learn how to use the cassette player. And
oh, I love that.
Cool.
But I mean, you know, there's an art to the pause. Versus mm-hmm. the stop. And I never got as far as splicing, but I love making collages and cutting out teen magazines. And like, I think my sister had Bop. Was that what it was called?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. With an exclamation point, I think.
Oh, yeah. My mom got really mad when I started cutting up the times, but yeah, I miss those days. I know when I get the stereo set up here proper, maybe I'll start making cassette tapes again.
Oh my God, that's great. You know, it's
do
something
you do that?
That I haven't done that in a long time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But, I haven't done that in a while.
But I'm happy that you brought up kind of the text element of it and the collage element, because that's not something we've really discussed on the podcast too much, but it also was a crucial part of the whole process.
Mm-hmm. You know? I still have a typewriter. I don't, you know, I'll use just for if I have a line here or there, and it's actually still, I don't know if I can turn this well enough for you to see, but I have it. There.
Oh yeah, on top of the piano.
Yeah. Yeah, so I have it there and I'm just like, oh, that's a good line, or this is just what I'm doing right now, and you know, just pieces here and there. If I'm labeling something and it just looks a little nicer with a strip of typed out, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, uneven text.
Yeah. I wanted to briefly discuss, there was a moment in time, I guess in like 08, 09, 10, where you were working or interning at Bada Bing and then also gigging. And I always thought it was so funny because we would speak through, you know, regarding your gigs. And then we would also speak through when I was running my old site, like setting up premieres and stuff. So I kind of knew you in two different ways, I guess. But yeah, I guess that you were kind of juggling multiple things, no?
Yeah, it was amazing. And I met Ben Goldberg, who runs Bada Bing, through my friend Alicia, who was his first employee, because she went to Middle Tennessee State. So when I moved back up north, I reconnected with her. And then she was working with him, helping him with Beirut when that was all happening. Mm-hmm. And I was working at Astor Wine. And, you know, I had almost taken this route into the wine industry because I'm such a wine lover. Mm-hmm. And I was like, maybe this is a stable career for me. but I was like, you know what? I think that should just be a hobby because I just enjoy it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But so I went from like working at Astor to interning at Bada Bing, and then between really two jobs and then playing nights, that like my schedule started feeling really crazy for being a New Yorker and like figuring out that balance in your 20s. Mm-hmm. He was super understanding and really supportive and liked me and needed a little extra help, so he offered to hire me properly. And so I let the Astor job go and worked at the label. And you know, I was afraid to tell him that I did music at first because I didn't want him to think I was doing it for the wrong reasons. Mm-hmm, right. Mm-hmm. I really just wanted to learn how to do it for myself because I was hand making my own CDs, and you know, I was more interested in how the industry worked, even though I wasn't even sure if I wanted to be a part of it yet. Mm-hmm. But seeing it from his side and how it was out of his apartment, and it was friends working together, putting them together and talking about ideas, like that is the side of the industry I felt lucky enough to be a part of early on and see that side of it. Because I think if I had gone to a major label, I would have been deterred to pursue music. But seeing it from such a grassroots level and like being through the eyes of a friend, I felt like this is something that made sense for me. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't, you know, I didn't know what blogs were. I didn't know about, you know, I knew MySpace, but that's mm-hmm. about it, I think. And MapQuest, just because I got lost all the time, but which is crazy to think about all those things and how much they've changed in really what was a small amount of time. He was very nurturing and, you know, taught me about elbows and how to research bands and who's writing about them. And all the music that you wrote about were things that I really connected with, and you supported the roster, and we, like, I still really appreciate it, and I still really appreciate you. Because it was, you know, I felt like those were pioneering times, and I didn't know anything, and I wasn't the best publicist, but I met a lot of amazing people through it, and, you know, so thank you.
That's sweet. No, I think all of us have fond memories from that moment in time, and kind of, I think all of us were juggling many things at once, so we can all kind of relate to that kind of life, you know.
Yeah.
That's just kind of how it was.
Yeah, we just made it work somehow.
You made it work, yeah.
And you know, I feel like the scene back then, at least, it was very like everyone was bonded together, I feel like, and in a really supportive way. And then there were so many different ways to like get exposed, let's say, for lack of a better term, but you know, like getting your, you know, song on some blog that was like blowing up, you know, you get a relationship to a publicist and then you just start going to all these shows because they'll just throw you on the list. And mm-hmm. then also in terms of like what you experienced, like really kind of getting to see like the other side, you know, like you were doing the creative side being an artist, but also getting to see kind of the business side is like so special, because I don't think a lot of artists, you know, really get that kind of education per se while they're...
It's funny when we talk about rollouts of records, like I get laughed at because I still believe in like the 6 month lead time and like the, you know, like the tiered kind of like release and you know, like like talking to people about specific times and, you know, premieres and stuff. But it's like I get so much anxiety when I hear like bands just drop a record without anything. I'm like, oh, what a nightmare. I'm like, good for you.
Yeah.
But I don't know how to, like, I don't feel safe in that, you know. I still like the build and I like the excitement of things being leaked and you mm-hmm. know, that kind of stuff.
Well, speaking of the build, I feel like your career has been a nice build. It hasn't necessarily been like 1 minute you're the trendiest thing and then it disappears. With each album, I feel like you have grown a larger audience and also have kind of really come into your own. And I mean, I'm not just saying this because we're on this call now, but I really feel like your last album was one of the strongest releases of the last few years, without a doubt, you know? And I just kind of feel like that's the kind of career growth that I think is sustainable, as opposed to kind of being flash in the pan. You know what I mean?
Well, it's just such a different time now, too, where it's a lot of singles. And I still don't fully understand the streaming world. And I pay attention, but I don't know if I subscribe to it. And I don't think I write the kind of music that is like trendy. So I'm not worried about sustaining anything that I never had. So I'm like, yeah, I know it's not, I, you know, talking to my team, I'm like, I know this isn't ideal and it's left of center and it's dark and the songs are more than 3 minutes, but hear me out, you know, like I've never had to explain myself. And I think being surrounded by the right people to encourage the choices and the tendencies that I have and keeping those people on your side, you grow together, mm-hmm. hopefully. Mm-hmm. And every time I make a record, I want to try something different. I still very much believe in the melody and the song in itself, and then I try to change something every time so I'm not making the same thing, because I know that I have certain sensibilities and I know that I gear, you know, I lean towards certain keys and tempos. I'm like, yeah, it's gonna be another mid-tempo dirge, everybody, so watch out. But you know, also to allow new people to come in and challenge me and push me to try things I never did before, because whenever I make a record, I always have this group of songs that I know that makes sense together, but learning how to work with somebody else and giving them those songs and giving them the freedom to take it somewhere, but also having the conversation about where you like what your influences are, or what the instrument, like what is the sonic palette, and what are your, give me three artists that like you're thinking about right now, or that you're listening to, or if there's none, you know, like some kind of dialogue to make it feel like a collaboration, even when you're kind of letting go of the songs. And then I, you know, for this past record, I literally gave John the songs. We had a long conversation about palette and influences. And then I just showed up at the studio as a singer, like karaoke to songs I've written I've never heard before. And it was scary, but it was one of the best experiences I ever had. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You kind of transitioned into also acting roles as well, which is like a whole other art form. How did that all come about, and how has that changed your life as well as an artist?
Well, I mean, it's all, like, the universe is a funny thing. I'll just say that because, you know, like, I remember it was a big dramatic kind of, it was after touring Are We There? And I decided to take a break from the road to focus on my life. About to go to, like, I just got accepted into Brooklyn College, and my manager gets an email for me to do a reading for the OA. And I was like, are you kidding me? I'm like, what? They're like, well, just to, you know, my manager was just like, just try it. I mean, you're home, it's shooting in New York. Like, who knows? You might not even get it. It doesn't matter, but it seems interesting. And I read the story, and the character, Rachel, was a singer that left home and to, you know, to pursue her career, and something intense happens on the way, and her voice changes. And so I connected to it, even though it was a sci-fi. I'm like, okay, this is kind of interesting. Do the audition. And I gave it my best. I thought I did pretty well. And then we left, and we kind of laughed, and we got a cocktail, and we cheersed, and we're like, oh, well, maybe next time. And then the next day, we got a call saying that I got it. And, you know, I was like, what? They're like, well, if you really want to do this, you have to report in 2 weeks, and it's going to be like two or three months of shooting, I think. Mm-hmm. Can't remember exactly now. But it turns out the casting director saw me and Zeke as a duo opening up for Nick Cave at the Beacon. And in his Rolodex of, you know, I don't know how many other, like, dark singer-songwriters he reached out to, but I think I know a couple. but they were just like, I came to mind in that role. But I think they reached out to other singers, but I won't say who. you can imagine. But so he ended up, you know, convincing me to go in. Like, my manager said, you should do this. And I even talked to my parents and Stuart Lerman, who produced my the Are We There record. And I was just like, should I do this? I feel like kind of a phony. Like, there was this big dramatic exit with my band for a pause for me to go back to school. But, like, now I'm going to take an acting job? Like, this seems kind of crazy. But even my mom just said, you can always go back, which is kind of funny now because she was always like the person telling me to go. I went, you know, I did the job and I did the acting, and you know, as long as I could defer my enrollment to the next semester, and I did the next semester, and then I found out I was pregnant. And so, like, all these things were like, what? The universe, again, we can't make this stuff up. Mm-hmm. So that kind of got me interested in that world and seeing how people interact and how they interpret a scene and how I can draw on my own experience as a singer and bring that into, like, onto set. But I still, like, I still don't think I'm very good, but I would love, whenever, you know, the environment allows, to take acting lessons. I would love to do that. And I'm actually taking a writing class right now at the community college, just online, and, you know, just kind of sharpening different tools because it is an interesting side of it. Yeah. But I don't know where it's going, though.
It was rewarding, though, I imagine.
I mean, you know, it's interesting because I've never been a part of a production before like that, and, you know, it's very different than plays and musicals in high school, mm-hmm. but it's like, it's not like you're rehearsing for this one day. It's more like you're supposed to show up and, like, know it, and then redo it. And you don't know what they're getting. Mm. Like, you don't know how they're, You don't know how they're shooting it. You don't know what sounds they're getting. You don't know what angle or whose perspective. And, you know, they're shooting everyone's perspective the whole time. So, you know, it's... But it was fun, and it was exhilarating, and it was scary, and I felt unworthy, and I felt bad, like, a, you know, I felt like I wanted to learn more immediately.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, even as a singer, you're, like, tapping into different emotions within yourself, and if you can, you know, convey, like, a story through song, you know, it seems reasonable to think that you could kind of tap into the same kind of, you know, talent or whatever to really kind of capture that character, maybe.
But, you know, it's like, for music, it's like I'm taking my own experience and putting it into song, whereas for a role, it's like I'm taking my own experience and being somebody else. So I think that's the main difference that I had a hard time. And, you know, at least when you're singing, you're, you know, I know that I'm making weird faces, but then I don't have to look at myself. But then it's like when you're acting and I'm like, oh, I do this. This is like, I made this face, I think, that whole season. I'm just like singing them. Like, I swear, you can like turn it into a fun drinking game. You're like, oh, she's doing the furrow again. Is she doing the furrow again? She is. You know, I'm like, I need to figure out, like, okay, now this. Yeah. I'm like, anyway, this is a podcast. Y'all can't see my faces, but I have a furrow. I have a furrow that I do, and my brow, and I actually have a permanent wrinkle. Because I remember even as a kid, my sister said I did the frown face, and I never realized that I did that until it was captured forever.
My goodness. Let's hop into Repeat Skip.
Okay.
The first album we're going to talk about is Portishead's live album from 98, although it was recorded in 97. At Roseland, which is no longer around in New York. Sharon, this was one of your high school favorites, no? This release?
Yes, I remember my friends and I would go on these beach runs after school. We'd try to go as fast as we can, and we went to this beach called Belmar. And one time we stopped, I think the town was called Brick, and there was a record store called Vintage Vinyl. And
Vintage Vinyl, I've heard of.
Yeah, so the two big stores are Princeton and Vintage, like Princeton Record Exchange and Vintage Vinyl. But that was, I remember walking in and just being like, this looks amazing. Like, I don't even know what this sounds like, but I was drawn to this cover. And I think you could set up the headphones and I listened to the opening track and my mind was just blown. I've never heard those kinds of sonics combined before. And I just remember thinking, like, how did I miss this? You know, because I got it right in the, I think it was 99 that I found it. But I was like, man, I guess it was 98 if it came out because it was on the stand. But I was like, did I just miss this concert? I lived here and I didn't know this existed. You know, like when the proximity becomes a curse to New York, I mean. But, yeah, that was like one of my first own discoveries, you know, outside of somebody playing me something that definitely continues to change and influence me.
Yeah, I mean, the first time I heard Portishead was when I saw the video for Sour Times in like 94 or something. And I was drawn to the strangeness of it all and the kind of the mystery. And I was... yeah, I just remember buying the cassette single when that was the thing. Nobody Beats the Wiz.
Wow.
Yeah, way nice. Back. And then just kind of falling in love with Dummy and then the self-titled album and then this. I think what's so great about this live record is that, well, first of all, it's just, I in my view, it's pretty flawless. But her voice, Beth's voice on record is, I mean, I don't even, stunning is an understatement. But in a live setting, she just takes it somewhere that is kind of like, atmospheric. It's really crazy. And like Jin and I were texting yesterday, like, it's not my favorite track actually, Sour Times, but in this live version, that last minute when the song really explodes and her vocals just kind of go off the deep end, it's chilling. Like, it's goosebump inducing for me.
I mean, to be able to capture something live, I mean, because what I love about going to shows is that you know you'll never see the same show again. And what's scary about recording it is that you can't really capture what you saw. Mm-hmm. But I feel like listening to this record, like, I feel like it's the closest thing to ever feeling like I'll be there. Mm-hmm. And I can feel her mic control, and I can feel like her feeling the audience and like the whole the people around her, and like, I don't know. I was like, this is somebody I want to be. Like, before I really knew I was going to be a singer there, I was like, I want to be her. Like, I want to be there, and mm-hmm. I want to understand.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish I was at that show. I mean, I guess I was like 16 or so when that show happened, and I wasn't really going to gigs in Manhattan, you know, not
yeah.
yet.
Yeah, I was definitely more of there was a place called King Buffet in like the downtown Main Street in Clinton. And it was more ska bands and jam bands. And the Firehouse had a couple of punk shows, but I didn't make it to a lot of shows in New York then in my teens.
Yeah, like I think I was just arriving in New York. I think I came to New York like August of 97.
Oh, wow.
I wasn't like cool. So, you know, like I was like, you know, late bloomer. Like we talk about this a lot, how Matt and I were kind of late bloomers. And me in particular, like New York was like a whole life education.
Oh, yeah.
I don't even think I was aware of Roseland. I think I was like going to NYU and like probably going to Irving Plaza. I remember like NYU one year, like they closed their venue and instead we're putting on shows at Irving. They're like, you know, programming board shows at Irving Plaza or something.
Huh.
And so, yeah, like I totally miss this. Listening to this album, it really, I feel like it's one of the best like live albums I've heard. It's
yeah,
just,
I agree.
It's so transportive and all just so many elements going on, and you just get like sucked into this like world, and then, you know, Beth Gibbons' voice comes in and it just like pierces your soul, you know, it's just like, and then, yeah. So I was just like, I was really happy you picked this.
Yeah, no, it's, yeah, it's so dynamic, and it's still very fresh to me. And I still don't think anyone's done anything to top this in my mind.
No, I had the opportunity to work with Domino on a release that Beth put out last year with the Polish
National Opera.
Yeah, it's with the Polish National Orchestra. Yeah,
very cool.
It's also a live recording. It was recorded in, I think, 2014, but it wasn't released until last year. She's not singing in English. She's singing in Polish. Yeah, it was.
Which is crazy, by the way.
It's so crazy.
Like she learned Polish for this.
Yeah, it was surreal. Like, first of all, that's also a stunning album, but, you know, I don't connect with it in the same way that I do with this release for obvious reasons. To have the opportunity to even work with her in, you know, kind of that way was kind of nuts. But, you know, I also love that she kind of keeps the mystery around her and doesn't give interviews and doesn't really ever talk. There's no stage banter, none of that. It's kind of like the lyrics kind of speak for themselves. Her live performance speaks for itself. And I think there's something to be said about that, because that's all you need with mm-hmm. someone who is an interpreter of song like that.
Yeah. And you're also like, you know, at a certain point, I feel like, early on, people told me, like, you know, try not to talk so much because you kind of, like, kill the vibe, you know? And I'm like, I get that. But I'm like, if I don't speak, then I'm going to cry because I don't know how to handle these emotions. But when I understand that when you have a mood and you're creating this mood and, like, the mood is just growing and it's more and more intense and it's more intense and more intense, and you choose to wait until you let that intensity go, like, that's when it's really powerful. And especially for their music, I feel like you have to kind of keep that intensity going, and they do that.
Yeah.
Very
it's
well.
It's kind of funny because, like, I was reading that, like, before this album came out, that people were kind of wondering if Beth could, like, sing live like she does in the studio. Like, she was kind of more self-admittedly like more of a studio singer. Mm-hmm. And then this album came out and everybody just shut up about that. Yeah. And they were like, oh, she can sing.
Yeah.
No. Yeah.
Yeah. I saw them at Hammerstein in 2011. So I waited like almost two decades to see them. And it was, I mean, otherworldly. It was so, so good. And actually at the very end of the show, Beth kind of was giving hugs to people in the front and I got a hug and I felt like, it was a moment for me.
Yeah. I've never gotten to see them live. So I'm shame on me. I wish.
Well, they don't really tour very much.
No. You know? I did get to see Jeff Barrow's band though.
Beak?
Yeah. They were at, what is that? Elsewhere? Mm-hmm. I saw them at Elsewhere, which, I mean, this feels like forever ago now, but they were really fun.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, very different.
Very different.
But, like, still got some proggy aspects of it. And but good vibes.
Yeah, for me, I really wouldn't skip anything on this release. But I think if I were forced to pick something I would skip, it would maybe be Half Day Closing, just because it's, like, a little warbly and it feels like you're kind of underwater a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that one kind of stands out as an anomaly. I don't know. But I mean, I love every track on this album, specifically Glory Box. I think it was kind of a treat to hear All Mine and
Only You.
Only You. Thank you.
Only You. Only
because
You. Yeah.
I feel like they don't perform those songs. They haven't performed either song live in decades. So I feel like in general these days when they do perform, which is so infrequent, they kind of skip that middle self-titled album, which is so good. I mean, they're all so good. So it was a treat to hear those.
I'll have to say, and I'll, you know, this is Sharon's confessional here, but this was definitely on my like makeout mix for sure. And at a certain point, like I remember there's some boy that was like, I think I've made out to this song too many times with other girls that I don't think I can like... I was like, oh, wow, this is a thing. I thought I was doing something very unique. So I think I nipped that in the bud early on.
In the bed.
But I was like, yeah, Only You is definitely one of those songs. And I was like, all right, when I want to take it down a notch, I'm going to like, you know, it's serious when Sharon puts that song on.
Oh my God, I love that. Yeah, there's something about the intensity of it that like feels it would feel appropriate in that kind of intimate moment for sure. What? Mm-hmm. What's your like favorite track on like the whole album?
Well, I mean, Only You is definitely one for me. There's a song called Roads that I remember being. It was on a soundtrack. It was like one of my first film festivals I went to for a bunch of college kids in Philly. And it was the closer to this short that was a really beautiful, I think it was like a black and white silent student film. But I just remember being moved by it. And I was like, oh, I actually know this song. But when you put picture to music, I remember specifically that just being elevated and, you know, not thinking about songs being closers or openers or, you know, creating a mood other than the mood that you put onto it. But it definitely felt like you were going somewhere in listening to that song. And I don't know, just like these memories just popped into my head as I'm like listening to all these songs. Like, I'm like, oh yeah, that's so weird. Why the weird things that you are imprinted from time. But I remember being at, watching student film in Philadelphia and feeling like it was just one of the most beautiful endings.
Yeah.
Wow. Were there any tracks you would skip? Because that was hard for me.
Yeah, it's very hard.
I honestly wouldn't. I don't think, if that's okay to say that. I mean,
I think this is a pretty perfect release, so
for sure.
I had a really hard time making one, but one I came up with was like Strangers, just because it just seemed more out of place in the context of all the other songs, not because it was a bad song or a bad performance, but it had a more like jazzy tempo to it, the way they were performing it. So it just stuck out a little bit more to me just in that way, but I don't know. I honestly would just listen to the whole album in one sitting.
Our second repeat skip is Liz Phair's sophomore album, Whip Smart, from 94. I gotta say, like, I was kind of introduced to Liz Phair with the White Chocolate Space Egg album mm-hmm. when I was like 18, 19, and then I kind of went backwards and then forward. So my starting point was there, but I kind of wish my starting point was earlier because this is a great album. But I'm probably more familiar with White Chocolate Space Egg and then for revisiting sure. Exile and then going forward. So this yeah. album is probably the one I'm least familiar with, to be honest, but it's a great one.
Yeah, it was the first one I heard, and I know it was kind of, I felt like, you know, I came into a lot of bands late where I got like the odd record, and I'm like, this is my favorite one, and everyone's looking at me like, what? Are you kidding me? Like, this is not what they're known for, but I mean, that's just where I came up, so I was like, I think I found this in 95 or 96, and so I was like a freshman or a sophomore in high school, and I remember it had like the white cassette with like the pink writing, and it was like her... You know, the star took up the whole front.
I love
front
that cover.
Yeah, it's just so, I don't know, it felt like fun but shocking in a way. And like she had this way of talking to you, like she was like a foul-mouthed friend of yours, you know, that you're just like sneaking cigarettes in the back of a gas station with or something. Like, I don't know, there's always been, she always just felt like a friend, you know, and it felt attainable mm-hmm. for some reason. Yeah. It was like, I relate to you. Mm-hmm. So that was something very comforting about her, this record to me. And I remember sitting on my, I shared a room with my sisters, and we had two twin beds with the pinkest flower comforters on there. And I just remember sitting, I had like my cassettes and shoe boxes, and sitting with my headphones listening to the Liz Phair tape for the first time over and over and mm-hmm. over again.
Yeah, I actually did have this, I think, on cassette now that you bring it up. But yeah, like I got into her during Exile in Guyville, so like when this album came out, she could do no wrong. And you know, I was just kind of like obsessed with her because I feel the same as you. Like she did seem like really relatable, and me being like a repressed teenager or whatever, like she was talking about all these like dirty things like it was just felt very like naughty to me in a way, but like very honest. So it was like really cool to just like see that voice out there that's like expressing, you know, just like normal life stuff mm-hmm. but you know, back then
no filter
to me. Yeah,
like Divorce and, Song was pretty like,
oh yeah,
still yeah. like a highlight for me totally. Of all of hers, but
yeah, Jen there. And I saw her at Prospect Park last summer, and she the encore was fucking Run and Divorce Song.
Oh, amazing. Yeah.
It was crazy because, like, Ted Leo came up on stage and sang fucking Run With Her.
Oh, no way!
We, like, lost our minds. Yeah. We were like,
that's awesome.
This is crazy. But, yeah, like, it was awesome to, like, revisit this album, actually. I hadn't listened to it in a while, and it's the funny thing about music is, like, you know, there's all these like memories and emotions attached to it, and they really do stick around, you know. Mm-hmm. So revisiting it was like a total like experience for me, let's say. I'd be like singing along, like, oh, I totally remember these lyrics, and I don't know. Did you have like a particular favorite on the album?
I like the slow jam the best. Is that shocking? Dogs of LA.
That's a good one.
It was definitely one I had on repeat over and over again. But yeah, I was just like, there's just something about the melody that was like kind of minor, but like kind of sci-fi. Like it felt like a piece of fiction for the, like in relation to her other stuff, you know. I was just like, I know it's a narrative, but it felt distant and mysterious. And I don't know, just I like the darker side of it without it having to be so upbeat, and like the swing to it that like made it feel hypnotic, but like for her it was pretty slow, so mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
I feel like there are a couple moments on this album that differ from Exile, and that she approaches the song a little differently, Some of the songs are a little slower or a little more introspective, or I don't know what term to use exactly, but there is a little bit of a different vibe in general. But that said, I'm super basic with my repeat, and I have to pick Supernova. I just think that is such a great single. I think it's one of her best like radio jam kind of songs.
My god, absolutely. And there was like the crazy wah that she had going on that like guitar solo or whatever. Not even a solo, it was like the main rhythm guitar throughout the whole thing. It was pretty ballsy, I have to say.
For me, it was like Nashville. I don't know how you guys feel about that song, but like once it came on, I was frozen, because I was just like all these like memories from like when I was a young teenager came back, and like it just like took a hold of something inside me, and I was like, whoa, I forgot how much I love this song. Aww. It's so crazy. It was a total trip to kind of revisit.
Yeah, going down memory lane there.
There's something about this album that's so quintessential, like I was going to say 90s, but specifically like 93, 94. It just sounds like it's from, like it just soundtracks that year so well. I can't really explain it. Like I hear these songs and I think of My So-Called Life, and I think of Manic Panic Hair, and I think like jeans with the, you know, the knee is all, a hole in the knee, like all that kind of stuff.
Oh yeah.
The Doc Martens. Like I just hear
the
it.
Flannel
when I,
shirt. Yeah.
Yeah. All
it's
of
all
it.
There. It's yeah. all there. I mean, it's like when, again, when the wah comes in and it's just, it's like this, a palette of the times with the pedals and stuff. I just feel like it's nice to go back to that place. I mean, I like timeless music as well for different reasons, but it's also nice to go back to somewhere specific.
Yeah. And she's still, I mean, when we saw her last year, I mean, of course she was great. Like it was kind of a joy to see her after all these years. Yeah.
I'm trying to remember where I ran into her. We played the same festival, and she actually made a point to say hi and just say like that she liked the record and everything. And like she even like gave me her number and was like, "I live by the beach. You should come by." I'm like, "What? Are you kidding me?" I'm like, "How am I gonna go to the beach with Liz Phair? I love you, but I don't know how to do this."
Right.
But she was super humble, and it was just nice. She's a human. She still got it.
Yeah, she does.
Oh my gosh, she was so good. I didn't know what to expect because I hadn't seen her live in so long, and she was like one of like the first kind of concerts I had experienced in New York just through NYU, and so for me to see her like last year was like such a trip. Definitely took me back to like the teen me.
It's a good place to be most of the time.
Yeah.
I had a hard time picking a skip too, but I don't know. I think I picked Jealousy just because, I don't know, it's just something about it that didn't resonate as much, I guess. I don't know.
I like that one. I mean, I feel like it's, it's upbeat, and I like the shakers in it and everything, but like just driving and fun and stuff, but for some reason the one that I always had a hard time with was Support System, like and maybe it was just like too much wah, or like because it came out right after Supernova that I was like I'm like, and also like, what do you mean you don't need a support system? Like, you totally need a support. Everyone needs a support system. What are you talking about? Like, I wanted to call her. I should text her right now. Everyone needs a support system. But I don't know. There was just something that like, maybe it was just the way it fell in the record, but like, sequencing is so hard. But.
Yeah. For me,
it's true.
For me, it was Shane. I don't know. For some reason, I couldn't get into that one as much.
Huh?
Yeah.
I like that one. I don't know what you mean.
Is there something that you're like, do you struggle with shame now? No.
I struggle with shame, yeah.
Is there shame in your past?
Maybe there was. I don't remember shame. But.
You didn't like that movie? That was one of my dad's favorite movies. Shane.
Shane? I don't know. Do I know Shane?
Know that.
I don't know Shane.
Oh, it's so old. It's like.
Oh my God, now I'm going to have to watch it.
Don't watch it. No, it's a sweet old, it's like one of his films. It was one of my dad's favorite films. So like he always would recommend it. It's kind of like Old Yeller vibes in a way.
Oh, got it.
Shane. There you go. I wonder if that's what it was about. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Needs a little homework after the episode. Well, thank you so much for joining us today for our season finale. I am so excited we got to talk with you.
Well, it's really nice to catch up with you and, you know, sending my love to East Coast and just, you know, thanks for always being supportive and thank you for just, you know, just being who you are and supporting music in general and just being good people. And I hope that you hang in there and stay positive and healthy and just know that I'm thinking about you out here. Thanks for reaching out.
Oh, of course. Likewise.
Thanks so much, Sharon. This was amazing and can't wait to hear new music from you. And I also really love, I just want to say I love the track you just released, Let Go. So good.
Oh, thanks.
And then it made me Google the documentary and I was like mind blown.
It's heavy. it's not light material and it's you know, it's obviously so relevant right now. And you know,
good on you for lending, you know, your voice to that, because that was literally everywhere. Mm-hmm. Like the, you know, and so I think that a lot of people are going to find out about that documentary because of your song.
Well, it was, I mean, so. Giorgio did a great job on it, as did everyone. I haven't met everyone on the team, but they were just so easy to work with and they're really sweet people and the documentary is really beautiful and I connected with it a lot. So I hope other people.
But it's called Feels Good Man.
Yeah,
right?
Feels Good Man.
So that was our season finale, season 3 finale with Sharon Van Etten. Thank you so much for joining us this season and we will catch you in the near future.
Next season
on Mixtape Memories. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.